Are you ready? I very much appreciate Brother Tim's detailed research. I wish he had more time. One thing that is a great difficulty and trouble in this day and time for all preachers who are diligent and all teachers of truth is that few people have time enough to listen to it. I was going to quote something from the Noble Lesson, just to back up just a little bit, the Waldensian people. And if you haven't read through the outline that Brother Binion did the first lesson, the one while I was gone, do so or review it, because many of the things that I tried to emphasize, there are quotes in that that are very good to substantiate the fact that those people were the Lord's people at that period of time. Exactly as I asserted, and gave a number of evidences. Well, he gave a lot of historical quotes that I didn't get to. But be sure and take a look at that, as well as the other outline, which leads on up into the American history that we ought to be so concerned with. That quote, which I, some of those old books are very difficult to find anything in. And I didn't start looking till today because I thought I could put my finger right on it. But if you have access to a book like Moreland's History or one of the others that has that in it, it's called The Noble Lesson, and I think it's the most convincing of all the ancient Waldensian documents of what they really were. They certainly believed in the kind of repentance and faith that we do, that has an experimental element to it and a revealed element to it, a spiritual element to it. And they were not Calvinistic, as a lot of your Protestant historians tried to insist that they were. At least they weren't in the 1100s. There are about three documents from the 1100s that claim by the internal evidence in the documents, at least two of them, and I think the third one is from the same vintage, to be written in the early 1100s. Well, everybody and his brother, as they say, that has a reason to discredit the Baptist, have tried to prove, or these people, even one, have tried to prove that these documents were written much later, which, if that's true, would make those dates a forgery. Well, one of those documents contains a statement about persecutions that they endured at the hands of the Pope's church, and it doesn't mention any persecution unto death. Therefore, what? Therefore, we know that the document had to be written for the middle 1100s, because that's when they really started to drive these people out of their homes and to persecute them unto the death. Whenever you study history, and I like to be very critical in my study of history, don't believe something just because one historian said it that way. The historian that gave me that little gem right there was very observant, because I was much disturbed about the claims, and I'll not give you the things that they set forth to indicate that those documents weren't written that early. But I was disturbed by that argument until I read that. It takes a very thinking, observant, honest person to say, hey, wait a minute. It had to be written for 1150 or 1170 or long in there, because they were putting them to death then. And how could anybody writing in detail in the persecutions they were enduring have failed to mention that? Isn't that overwhelming? Do you see what I'm saying? Learn to read history that way. And it reminds me of the claim of Charles Darwin's conversion. I was reading that first time I saw it, and I got through it, and I thought, well, hey, this is neat. And I got down to a certain place where Mr. Darwin said something, supposedly according to the narrator, which could not be true. At least I don't think so. In defense of his early writings, he said, I was a young man with unformed ideas, and other people took my ideas and made a religion out of them. He was 60 years old when he published that very damaging book, The Descent of Man, 62, I believe. It's not hard, a young man. And my point is this, is that we need to be very careful about believing what we want to believe when we read something, but we want to look at the evidence. I think the proofs have been well presented of the early Waldensian origin, all the way back to the almost the apostles' time and the connection with the true church. And what we presented so far well proves the connection of the Waldensians with the Anabaptists and the Anabaptists with the English Baptist or the British Baptist. And then, of course, we know very well that the American Baptist, of which we are a remnant, came about from the British Baptist. Now, I want to say just a word, and I'm just plugging a few holes before I get to the main body of what I'm going to say tonight. There was a time when one of the historians said all England was Calvinistic. I shouldn't have to prove that because they adopted the Westminster Confession as the Anglican Confession of Faith. How did that happen? I mean, this shortly before that, England was one of the most staunchly Catholic nations on earth. In fact, there's a good argument that the Irish were not Roman Catholic until the English put them in subjection in about the 12th century. And have been ever since. Well, then the English turn around and reject a papal religion somewhere around the 1500s. They were strongly influenced by a number of sources, but the one that's the most visible is the Calvinist in Geneva. The Reformed churches in Switzerland, of which John Calvin was the primary head and left his name as Calvinism upon the doctrine that those people adopted. They got a lot of strength from Geneva, and many of the powerful churchmen, even in the days of Henry VIII and Queen Elizabeth, James, were staunch Calvinists. In other words, the historian said all England was Calvinistic. There's one exception to that in the 1600s and the 1500s, and that was Anabaptist. Anabaptists, which had, they stated it plainly back when everybody hated them in England. They said, they're Dutch. They're Dutch Anabaptists, and they're over here in England, and they're corrupting our country with this. And when James had the Authorized Version translated in 1611, it was a crime to rebaptize an Anglican. In fact, it was a serious crime. You could be put to death for it, for rebaptizing these people who had been sprinkled in infancy. And some were back in the 1500s. It changed rapidly in the 1600s, and it's only natural to think that after a while, with thousands of Anglicans, Church of England people, having not been out of Catholicism that long, thousands of them becoming first independents and then Baptist. And they just, we see this a lot. They're making a transition that they would hang on to some of what they already believed. In other words, they converted enough that we could rightly call them Baptist, and I believe that, but they didn't convert completely to what the first Baptist in England believed. They held on to their Calvinistic belief. And by the time America was being populated, they had become dominant for one reason or another, which we'll not get into. I think I know some of the reasons that happened. Well, one of them is the Quaker movement have subverted hundreds of General Atonement Baptist churches. Didn't have too much effect on the particular Baptist. Well, a lot of these particular Baptist men who were highly educated, coming out of the Anglican Church or the Independents that had once been Anglicans, viewed the denomination that they had joined up with as simply the most reformed and purest of the Protestants. You'll see that when you read John Bunyan, you'll see that when you read John Gill, and even Charles Spurgeon, this very dominant line of thought among the British Baptists. Well, you say, well, that's wrong. Yes, it is wrong. But how much did it hurt? And the answer is not much back then. Because nobody, but nobody, but nobody else was immersing but Baptist. There wasn't the danger of receiving somebody else in baptism because nobody else was doing it. And when one of the great contributions that Grace Pendleton and Dayton and the Landmark Movement made is just in the nick of time, they asserted that we ought not to receive these baptisms from that other denominations were beginning to produce. My grandfather, I didn't hear him say this, he died when I was 4 years old. I do remember one incident with him, but he was a Baptist deacon. My mother said he taunted the Methodist with this statement, sprinkle, pour, or dip, anyway not to let members slip. You see, in the beginning, their preachers, none of them were immersed, but they were immersing other people. That really doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? If I was going to get immersion, I'd want to go to somebody that had it. And that's a pretty logical step, but at any rate, by the late 1800s, not only the Methodist, but dozens of offspring of the Methodist, and in this century, hundreds of offspring, we call Holiness Pentecostal, and hundreds more we would call fundamentalist-type churches, not to mention Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, and a lot of others. They all immerse. You going to accept all that? Didn't have to worry about it back in that day. But I call the view that Baptists are just the most perfectly reformed of the Protestants, I call that Protestant Baptist. And the other view is Landmark Baptist, that the Baptists really are true descendants of the Waldensian people and the Anabaptists that followed them and successors of the Church of the Apostles. And I believe that to be true. And the churches that have received all sorts of baptisms from other beliefs in great numbers have rapidly changed to adopt some of the views of those people that they were taking into their churches. In other words, it corrupted the doctrine in a very short time. And we'll not go any further into that. All right, so when the early Baptists in this country were making such great gains, there was a strong Calvinistic or predestinarian element. You know what brought them back from that? They swayed way over here. You know, I think they had been pretty far over here in the Arminian, emphasizing the will of man. Now, Arminian are not necessarily free will, but they do include the will of man in this salvation that you get. It is a factor, and I believe that. If that makes me Arminian, so be it. However, I don't admit being an Arminian or a Calvinist, because that is a Presbyterian controversy and never should have gotten among the Baptists, who simply believe and have believed, like the Waldensian people and the Anabaptists, that you must be born again in time. And that is the focal point. You must be changed by grace. You either are or you are not. And whether you were, it was determined and you were predestined to it or foreordained to it or not, you must have it. But you'll find a lot of the historians indicating that most of the people who rejected true experience with God were Arminian or free will, and that's not true. It's not true. In fact, if I have the time tonight, I'm going to try to show you that Very unexpectedly, almost all of the advocates of just accepting Christ, and you can't get any more free will than that, came out of the Calvinists rather than the Arminians. Almost every one of their great figures that emphasized everybody in that direction. And that sounds like an irony, doesn't it? It is a sort of a paradox that that happened that way, but it did, and I think I know the reason for it. We'll maybe get to that a little bit later. Okay, I want to mention just a few things. We took a trip to Virginia a few days ago that I've been wanting to take for years to check out something I read in the history book. And those Baptist historians, I found out at least this one was pretty reliable. This great awakening in Virginia that occurred just before the Revolution had a great deal of effect on our situation today that otherwise never would have been. The Baptists were the primary actors and recipients in that Great Awakening in Virginia, which followed the Great Awakening in the Middle Colonies and in New England, which began in the Middle Colonies about 1720 and in the New England area in the 1730s, and then continued on until in the 1750s. It began, 50s and 60s began in Virginia, under the influence of separate Baptists who were newly converted Baptists from up in Massachusetts and Connecticut, the Puritan states. They had been changed in their thinking by the outpourings of God's Holy Spirit that were the greatest, I think, that have ever occurred since the days of the apostles, as far as we have any record. To change a whole society. There's a whole new hemisphere here, and God was not about to let what we started here go the wrong way. There was the best of the best, the most fearless and the most, I'll just leave with that, the bravest of the Europeans that had the nerve to come across the Atlantic for a better life and more freedom, and among them were numerous people who were very religious. And the majority of the people who came to America may not have come for religious reasons, but let's say they were easily converted because of the character they had. And very rapidly, the true language of the Spirit of God was adopted by thousands and thousands of people. You must be born again. You must know the Lord. You must be led by the Spirit. This is real. It's not something that we just talk about, something abstract. But it's real. God speaks to people, doesn't he? And he speaks conviction to their sinful hearts and peace to their troubled souls to let them know that he has forgiven them and that they're saved. That was what America, that is what America was, is a revival of primitive Christianity, if you look at it from a religious standpoint. And the Great Awakening revivals are from God. It's not strange that the only denomination that was not permanently split or badly put in disarray by this phenomenon were the Baptists. Why? Because this was already a strong point of their doctrine. It was not a strong point of Presbyterian doctrine, not a strong point of the Anglican doctrine, not a strong point of the Puritan doctrine. They all had people in their churches when they were unconscious babes. And those people would grow up, and no matter what they tell you, they would try to convince them they were okay. Had the churches full of unsaved people, the Baptists alone said you have to have a salvation experience, and even some of them, their ears drifted for some time away from that and had to be brought back. It's an easy thing to depart from because you have to be spiritual to hang on to it. And maybe that's going to be some of the explanation for the phenomenon that we're facing and having such a hard time with in this time. Also, by the end of the Second Great Awakening, the revival, the language of the Spirit, had brought the Baptist, as well as others, a great distance from this diehard predestinarian position. The Second Great Awakening, the first one, I believe, and you'll hear various arguments on this, and I think I can prove this pretty well, begin with the Dutch Reform in the 1720s and continued until about 1790, when very conveniently our Constitution Bill of Rights was finished. And then there was a real dearth, a famine for a little while. And the result of that was it caused a lot of preachers and people to get up and go across the mountains into Kentucky, Tennessee, and points further west. And in on the frontier in 1800, the revival was, a second great awakening began. And by 1820, 25, it had ebbed out, and a very different phenomenon appeared. See if I want to put anything else in there before I get to that. Yes, I want to show you just a few pictures here. Probably could get by without this, but that's something I want to do, so we're going to do it. And we'll try not to take too much time. Had a wonderful time traveling up the Piedmont region of Virginia a week or so ago. Down in here is where Schubel Stearns, the most notable of the separate Baptists from up in Massachusetts, Connecticut area. He felt burdened for Virginia, and he came down to here where there was a bunch of regular Baptists, and for some reason he didn't stay. Went on down in here. Didn't like it there either for some reason. So he went on down here into North Carolina, where it was an Anglican colony, Episcopalian, but they were a lot more moderate in their attitude about people who didn't agree with it. So Sandy Creek Church right down in here was started, and it just, well, let's just say in a few years, his brother-in-law Daniel Marshall and several others had evangelized South Carolina down this direction and Georgia. Just hundreds of churches were planted in a very short time. Meanwhile, across the border in Pennsylvania County, Virginia, a fellow by the name of Dutton Lane was saved, called to preach, and began a church over there. And then a marvelous man of means and reputation, Colonel Samuel Harris, was converted. I have his salvation experience recorded, and it's beautiful. It said Colonel Harris was down on a bench with his feet hanging over one side and his head and hands hanging over the other side, apparently unconscious for a while. What does that sound like? It sounds like what we're always being ridiculed for, doesn't it? But after a while, Samuel Harris began to come to, and he began to raise up and clap his hands and praise the Lord. Well, you know, some people say the mourner's bench hadn't been invented yet. And even if that's true, that's what he was on, was a mourner's bench. You see, it just hadn't been taken by a fellow like Charles Finney, who very badly misused it in the 1820s, and people say he invented it. That's not true. That little illustration there proves it. I also could give you a quote about how both the separate and the regular Baptist practiced their evangelism in the year 1800. When the preacher would get through preaching, he would start a hymn or give out a hymn. I suppose he started it. And he would walk down out of the pulpit, and he would invite anyone who felt that they were under conviction for their sins and God was drawing them by his Spirit. You're not going to get anywhere anyway if he's not. If they would wish to come to the front and kneel down in front of the stage, sounded to me like the bench was missing, that the congregation would unite in prayer with them for their conversion. I like that. Amen. We shouldn't let the bench get in the way, should we? Because it's not really necessary. It's that sanctuary of God's people and the power of the Lord that's so important. And I know the churches that I grew up in years ago had a habit of saying somebody was in the altar. And one sister out in this area, she said, "What do they mean in the altar? Don't they mean on the altar?" I said, "No, sister." I said, "A lot of those churches don't have a bench up front at all. And to them, up here where people gather for prayer is the altar, and you can get in it." So the preposition made sense to those folks. It was a matter of being in a spiritual place.
Amen.
And of course, as they say, you can make an altar anywhere that God will permit you to, and surrender yourself to Him and be saved. Well, getting back to the map, we drove up through here, Shenandoah Valley, which is absolutely beautiful, and through the pass over to Charlottesville, which is just south of Charlottesville, is Jefferson's home in Albemarle County, Virginia. Harris went all the way up to Culpeper in a short time. The Golden Revival's up there, and things just exploded. The regulars had come a little ways down here, and it wasn't too long until they were cooperating and working together. And they went this way, big time, as they say. And this Piedmont region, you see right up here is where the regulars started. Well, actually, in the tip of West Virginia. And the separates came this way, and they united in the 1780s and called themselves United Baptists. Anybody ever heard of that? That's where that name came from. What most of them were going under when they crossed the mountains and went over into Kentucky this way and Tennessee. Now, it wasn't long until they were the dominant sect in Virginia and had the most influence. Up here in Orange County is where James Madison lived. And that's where, of course, his home, Monticello, Jefferson's home down here. And in Orange County is Montpelier, which means Mountain View. And you do have a marvelous view of Blue Ridge from there. It's a beautiful place. Well, in 1774, a newly converted separate Baptist by the name of John Leland, a very outstanding fellow, he came to Virginia, led of the Lord, a Baptist preacher, and he settled in Orange County. He became very good friends between then and 1791 when he went back to New England, right after the Bill of Rights was ratified. Man had a great purpose, a political purpose. During his stay, religion was disestablished in Virginia. The second government on all of the face of the earth to declare total freedom of conscience and equality of all citizens, regardless of their religion, was Virginia, 140 years after the first government, which was Rhode Island, which had had freedom for all people for about 140 years in the colony and then in the state. That being done, John Leland went back to Massachusetts and lived till 1841 and spent the rest of his life using his pen, doing the same thing that Isaac Backus was doing, attempting to disestablish religion in the most stubborn religious state of the Union, Massachusetts, and the second most, Connecticut. Connecticut finally got rid of all their state religion in 1819 and Massachusetts in 1833. I'll let you figure out how many years that is after independence and after the Bill of Rights. Obviously, the Bill of Rights was not intended, the First Amendment was never intended to tell the states that they couldn't have a state religion. Isn't that amazing? But they voluntarily, one at a time, became convinced that the federal government and Virginia and Rhode Island were right. And later on, the federal government has taken the liberty to apply the First Amendment all the way down to the local school board. This is a recent addition. And I don't think there's any possibility of undoing that either, people. You think what you want to about it, but now that the federal courts have defined the local schools as a government entity, the Constitution plainly says the government shall not favor any establishment of religion. Well, until these court rulings came along, I grew up in a Baptist community, and Baptists had the biggest sway in the school. And we did a lot of things that were somewhat religious according to the Baptist line of thinking. And I'm of the mind that federal government ought to have stayed out of it. Amen. And let the localities work it out among themselves like they always did. If you didn't like the way a teacher was influencing your child, you either went to her or him or to the board and you settled it. And certainly I do not believe that even in a private school in taking advantage of someone else's children. I mean, there's a right way and a wrong way to do these things. But let me show you some pictures, and we're going to go over time a little bit tonight. Right up here, we went to Montpelier in Orange County, and I said, where's the Leland Madison Park? I had called the Historical Society, got literature from them and some other groups that should have known those things in Orange County. We never heard of it. We poor Baptists really get a bum rap, you know that? And so I found one remarkable young lady who was a guide there at Montpelier, and I thought, before I get away, I'm going to ask her what she knows about it. And I said, you know anything about a Leland Madison Park in this county? She said, no. Now, there's a Leland Park, she said, upside the road on up north of Orange, town of Orange. I said, that's probably it. But she said, I never heard it called Leland Madison Park. So there were two older women there, and she said to them, she said, you know anything about Leland Madison Park in this county? No, they didn't know a thing in the world about it. But one thing they did do in the film at Montpelier, and I appreciated this, you've heard me say this if you were here the first three sessions, that the reason James Madison was so determined to disestablish religion is because he was ashamed the way his church treated the Baptists and their preachers in the 1760s and early 1770s. That's in the film at Montpelier. I said, yeah, I'm glad of that. They at least got that in there because that's the truth. And it's not just because it gives us a promotion, people. It's because it is a fact, and that's important. And we want to be careful ourselves of bending the truth to try to give ourselves an advantage. Paul said, what was it he said? If the truth of God be more... how's it go, Brother Tim? By my lie, if it be more advanced by my lie, that's not an exact quote, why am I myself judged as a sinner? What kind of a guy would I be if I could use a lie to promote the truth? No, I'm just a poor old sinner, and I dare not do that, ever. Okay, so we want to be sure we're right. But we went on up north of Orange, and late in the afternoon we found it. I want to show you some pictures of it, right beside the road. Now that's me getting some videos there of the monument that's been erected there. And we'll try to show you what's on here in a little bit. There's the one that I'm kneeling down to. My wife sneaked up behind me to take a picture, and I said, be sure you get the camera. I don't want somebody to think I'm down there worshiping that monument. Okay, so... it says here, if we can read it, dedication of Leland Madison Monument Park, religious freedom for all, October the 4th, 1953, put up by the Orange County J.C.'s. Well, that's not all that was involved in that. Let's see what else we have here. We'll put these down here. Now, if you go up that way, it's on the main road, 4 miles north of the town of Orange, on the same road that Montpelier is on to the south, and I'm going to try my best to get the people of Montpelier to tell people, go on up there and see it. Leland Madison Park, under the direction of the Goshen Baptist Association. That's one of the old ones, and they're Southern Baptists today, and I think quite modern according to our standards. Now there's my beloved wife there, standing under the tree that traditionally is thought to be the one that John Leland, Baptist preacher, met James Madison, his congressman, under, and had a conference with him that resulted in the Baptists going along with the adoption of the Constitution in return for a promise of immediate submitting of a Bill of Rights, which James Madison, that same man, authored a short time later. Excuse me. That's quite a large tree, but being the stickler that I am for accuracy, I'm going to go to people who know and say, could that tree be 300 years old? It's a white oak. I've never seen one nearly that big. And if so, then it may in fact be the tree that they met under. If not, it's probably someone's wishful thinking. There's a picture of the monument up close, thanks to Brother Tim's expert work on the computer. Now, there's what it says. This is John Leland, courageous leader of the Baptist doctrine, ardent advocate of the principle of democracy, vindication of separation of church and state. Near this spot in 1788, Elder John Leland and James Madison, the father of the American Constitution, held a significant interview which resulted in the adoption of the Constitution by Virginia. Baptists were the main constituents, remember that. And there was a lot of opposition other than Baptists to the Constitution without a Bill of Rights appended to it. As you know, if you know your history, the Constitution was adopted without a Bill of Rights, and it was added about 2 years later. Then Madison, a member of Congress from Orange, presented the First Amendment to the Constitution, guaranteeing religious liberty, free speech, and a free press. This satisfied Leland and his Baptist followers. This was presented by Eugene Buckman Bowen, president of the Berkshire County, Massachusetts chapter of the Sons of the American Revolution. So that gives it a little bit of validity as to its authenticity. Now here's one that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but what you'd like to see it. I enjoyed that, and I enjoy looking at that picture, especially because I've got one of my former deacons in the pillory with me. But I will say this, he's not as capable of enduring persecution as I am, because he didn't stay in it very long. He took the second picture, he was gone. Someone else was in there, and I was still there. I sort of enjoyed the experience. It's kind of like wearing the crowns of thorns that I make out of these old green briars. It's good for you. And if we would wear the crown of thorns spiritually, and what it symbolizes, I think we would all be able to cope with this terrible apostasy that we have been suffering for the most part of our lives. We are in the midst of the greatest apostasy that has occurred in the world, that is fallen away since the one that occurred after the apostles died. The great falling away Paul spoke about, I presume to be the one that began before the Apostle John stopped writing in the scriptures and became very, very bad in the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries and resulted in a great force of evil under the name of Christianity, which many centuries later began to kill God's people by the millions, counting them to be heretics. How did this happen? Well, I want to quote John Leland on a few things, and I'm not going to take much longer, so don't get uneasy, even though it seems like we've got a long way to go. And I want to reemphasize, people do honor God by studying this. You need to know these things so that you know how to answer people on lots of things that they need to know. Not to vindicate the Baptists, God will do that at the judgment, but because how are people going to find the old paths if they don't know what they are? How are you going to tell them if you don't know what they are? And returning to the old paths wherein is the good way is an essential if there's going to be blessings of God returned like they once were. This is just a portion that someone gathered together of John Leland's writings. And he was one, almost 800 pages. You don't have any trouble when you read through this seeing that it's very likely that this man who lived neighbors to Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, 24 years of presidents, the 3rd, 4th, and 5th in a row, shaped this country, lived right in that little area of Virginia, all three of them completely surrounded by Baptists and Baptist churches during most of their lives. And certainly were up until after all those men died, left this world. John Leland was good friends with Thomas Jefferson. See, a lot of the Puritans couldn't stand Jefferson because he denied the Trinity. You see the difference in them and the Baptists? They're intolerant about everything. If you don't believe what I believe, you're stupid. Don't be that way, people. We've had a lot of Baptists that have gotten into that attitude and stand up and beat their breasts and say, we are the one true church. How about proving that by the love of God among you? The world will know that you're my disciples not by the doctrine or the history that you present, nor by the eloquence with which anyone speaks, but by the love that you have one for another. That's what the scripture says. There ought to be a love in our churches that exceeds anything that anybody has seen among any other denomination. And folks, tolerating evil is not the way to accomplish that either. You know, it's a way to defeat. It's a way to make it where you can't do that. You need to help one another, and I didn't mean to get into that, but we need to be what the Lord could use to display us and say, look at that. And from time to time that happens, in spite of all of our faults as individuals and churches, we'll get, by the grace of God and by His mercy, full of the Spirit, and someone will come in among us and they'll say, I've never seen anything like that before. I've never seen love like that. Well, it's not that we can't be very disagreeable to one another, and we shouldn't be, but sometimes we are. But at that moment, we weren't. You see, because of the love, what really is inside is on the outside, overflowing and flowing among us. And those who came in and didn't understand that sensed it. And they will. I think among all of our churches that Victory is one of the better examples of that today. And I don't say that to swell your head. I mean that sincerely. But the more we get close to God and right with Him, and the more love that we have, and the less worldliness we let get in the way, and the less fleshliness we let in our lives, the more that is going to be pronounced in the eyes of the world. And so this man had a tremendous influence. Talking about Calvinist, which he claimed to be one, but how Calvinistic was he? One of his statements, according to Benedict, was 3 grains of Calvinism and 2 grains of Arminianism make a tolerably good mixture. Why, some of those Calvinistic writers that I read, including J.H. Grime, would have had a hemorrhage on hearing that statement, if you'll pardon the expression. That's what he thought. And, you know, the people in Virginia, they worked around a way to get everybody to adopt the Calvinistic confession by promising they wouldn't hold them to it. Well, Jesus adopted it, you're not going to hold them to it. Well, of course, Baptists never did hold anybody to the confession because the Bible is our rule of faith and practice. But he commented that he thought that the Georgia Baptists had done a more reasonable thing in that they didn't adopt any confession. So how Calvinistic was Mr. Leland? What I want to get to is this. In 1826, there was a lawyer in New York that was converted to Christianity. I think Charles Finney really got saved. But he immediately began to preach, joined the Presbyterians, a Calvinistic group. But he was far from being Calvinistic, and he was far from being the evangelist of the Great Awakening. He was the first one of great note to hurry him through, push him through. He invented the anxious seat, or at least he popularized it. And sometimes our mourners' benches have been called anxious seats. You know, the people come up and sit on them. Well, it's all right. You can get saved sitting down the same as you can down on your knees on the floor. But if somebody was standing up there exhorting you the whole time you were sitting there, that's not exactly a place of prayer, is it? That's what Finney did. It was a place to exhort him, to urge him, push him through. Now, I don't know how many got saved within his revival, but I know whenever that burnt over district of New York, that's what they called it, because there's so many religious revivals occurred there. In the 1830s and 40s, by the time all the dust had settled, you had Mormons. You had, coming out of that, Joseph Smith supposedly got saved in that. I don't believe he did. I don't know what you think. One of the biggest frauds that ever hit the world since the days of Muhammad. Reminded me very much of Muhammad in many ways. And a number of other religions. Adventists came out of that later revival on a little bit farther up north in toward New England, or in New England. Later on, in the same type of revival fervor, you have Jehovah's Witnesses appearing. Back up just a little bit, and you've got the big Shaker movement that came out of that sort of revival. You may not even know what that is, and we'll not get into it tonight, but you need to find out. They're extinct now, except for the ruins of what they've left behind, or places, the communes, or whatever you call them, where they dwelt. But just a lot of things that would say, hey, this wasn't really that good. One writer called it freedom's ferment. And it was like something was fermenting or spoiling. And I thought that was a pretty good title. John Leland lived long enough to see Phineas Revival. And here's what he had to say about it in very short order. It is not the voice of my master. Pretty weighty, isn't it? Well, I agree with that, but a lot of people went with that big evangelism. What was Finney trying to do? Well, he was trying to recreate George Whitefield and John Wesley and the great notable of Protestant evangelists. You see, the Baptists didn't have any of them. Schubel Stearns might have equaled George Whitefield or Whitfield, whichever way he pronounced it, in his abilities, but if that be true, it was never... didn't make the newspapers. You know, it didn't make the textbooks or the history books. Certainly his success was rivaled Whitefield's. But Whitefield was a Methodist, an Anglican priest who became one of the Methodist founders. And the Wesley brothers were the same. One was Calvinistic, Whitefield was, and Wesley brothers were Arminian. But they were the founders of Methodism. Most of Whitefield's followers in America became Baptist. No other place for them to go. At least not any reasonable place for them to go. But the great Protestant evangelists were there. See, Wesley and Whitefield were the instruments God used to convert thousands and thousands of formal Anglicans to believe that you had to have a born-again experience. God did that. Charles Spurgeon was a Baptist in name and recognized as a Baptist, even though he was a Protestant Baptist, but he said Whitefield and Wesley were the two men that deserved to be classed among the apostles the most of any since the days of the apostles. That was his opinion. I've got it in writing. And they weren't either one Baptist. They were both Methodist. Well, you see, Spurgeon comes the closest to being a great man, except maybe John Bunyan, of any great man we've got under the Baptist name in all of this. Maybe it's because he allied with the Protestants so much and praised them in some ways rather highly. This is the 1830s and 40s, and America had reached its zenith of spirituality, in my opinion. It's been downhill ever since, spiritually. But what spirituality, true spirituality, does for society always lags of many years behind. America continued for decades, maybe even a century, to reap the benefits of this great Christian revival. I was reaping the benefits in 1955 when I got saved, even though the great apostasy had reached amazing, astonishing proportions already at that time. The religion of the Great Awakening Revival that so enhanced the Baptist and so converted other denominations was still moving in Southwest Missouri in 1955. And as a matter of fact, it's still moving in 2000. It may be moving pretty slow. Well, you know, there's something else tried to happen. A fellow named Alexander Campbell come over from Presbyterian Scotland and spent his life trying to destroy the concept of experimental knowledge, religious feeling, religious emotion. He was a Sandemanian, if the truth were known. Now, Sandeman was a Calvinist. Campbell wasn't. But he preserved Sandeman's most notable characteristic. He hated anything that smacked of mysticism or mystery, or in fact, spirituality. He called one of their historians who linked the two together quite well, called what we believe about the salvation experience mischievous mysticism. Well, it's not mysticism at all. It's as real as you sitting there, Brother Binion. It's as real to me, if not more so, than the people I'm seeing in this congregation tonight. I was told once I had a hallucination by a man to whom I told my experience, and I just simply asked him how long one lasted, because I'm still having it. And I've been telling that ever since. It's real, and it's of the Spirit, and it's of the doctrine of the church, and it is one of the, it is the greatest thing. It is the rock on which the church is built, and it is the greatest proof that we're right. We're still hanging on to that. We're the remnants of the only denomination that wasn't split by that, that New Light movement. I can show you a quote where the regulars wrote to the separates in Virginia, and they said, "We are all New Lights." Well, you know, the pro-line Presbyterians, oh, they would have had a hemorrhage if they'd been called a New Light. Because that was their people that they thought had gone berserk, were the New Lights. Same way with the Puritans. But to the Baptists, both groups, and we're all New Lights. We all believe in this New Light experience. Now, if you hear the expression New Light used today, be careful with it, because it's being used in a different sense with some people. But it was a good one back then. Not the Spirit of my Master. Well, Campbell didn't get very far. He did subvert a few hundred Baptist churches, by the way, many in Kentucky and Tennessee. All of them in Ohio. You want to know why that the Baptists didn't proceed on across the north like they did the south? I think he's one of the big reasons. He subverted everything in Ohio to that movement at the time. And the Baptists went in there after that, but it just like that's where the big influence stopped. Now, the Baptists got their head on straight, got together, analyzed his doctrine, put out the word on him, and put a stop to it. He had a lot of following by that time, but that's as far as he got, as far as subverting Baptists. In 1875, or thereabouts, there was a man who had to go to Europe to get famous. An evangelist that began very much like Charles Finney. His name was Dwight L. Moody. He come back a hero. He made a big hit in Scotland where they hate religious emotion. And that's the truth. That's where Campbell came from. Nothing against the Scotch, but they better get some religious emotion if they're going to hell. And there's an awful lot of that that came out of there. You know, the old intellectual Scotsman, you know, wants to think everything out. Well, I guess that appealed to them, and I'm not blaming it all on them, but Scotch Presbyterianism is a great contributor to the heresy that I'm talking about that's so subtle that succeeded where Campbell failed. Dwight L. Moody was a congregationalist nominally. But really, he just went out and did his own thing. And since he didn't have a salvation experience, he didn't think you needed one. And he had campaigns all over the northern part of the United States in which They went for weeks and thousands of people professed. His method was the inquiry room, where those who showed an interest were herded off into another area, and there they were prayed with and or exhorted unto until they professed. And they really didn't intend for anybody to get out of there without getting saved. And I guess some did, but there was something wrong, they thought, if you did. Dwight Moody became so popular that almost all of your evangelists in the Protestant realm, including many Baptists, began to imitate him. He died in 1899, if I remember correctly, and by the beginning of this century, many Baptists were buying into those big mass revival things. And they were beginning to fill up their churches with unsaved people. And then along comes another one. You know what his name was? Billy Sunday. Even more outrageous than Moody, he was a baseball player, an entertainer. You talk about really getting wild with his preaching. I read where a Jew said that in the Great Awakening Revival, the preacher just stood up and preached the truth. Jonathan Edwards read it from manuscript, I'm told. And another place I read where he wore a black robe and a powdered wig. I don't know if that's true or not, that's what I read. But people in the audience were so moved that they got to where some of them would fall on the floor and writhe on the ground in agony. In other words, this Jewish fellow that wrote this history said in the first Great Awakening and the second, the preachers preached the truth and the crowd got animated. By the time of Moody and Sunday, the people were supposed to sit in stone silence and the preacher got animated. Big difference there. And all there was for the people to do was those who are not yet professed to get up and come down front and get saved. Well, by the time Sunday had finished with it, all you had to do is come down and shake his $4 million hand. That's how much he made from preaching. That was his net worth. And some people criticized him and that $15,000 diamond stick pin he wore on his coat. And he said, well, I won 2 million souls to the Lord. You know, that's $4 million. I mean, what is it, $2 a soul? That's what he's quoted as having said. That's getting pretty arrogant. Well, it was a long time before one rose that matched Billy Sunday. There were evangelists like Mordecai Ham and numbers of others that tried to imitate Moody and Sunday in every decade. But finally one arose under the name of Baptist. You know what his name was? Billy Graham. Billy Graham is a Moodyite. He's a Sundayite. He's not a Baptist. Never was. And if you meet him in heaven, I'm going to be surprised. Because I wouldn't give you that for the experience he tells. And I've seen it written more than one way in his own hand. It just doesn't add up with what is required in the Bible and in Baptist doctrine. Well, what did that do? Well, it helped to marry the Southern Convention to this phenomenon, which I call fundamentalism. There's nothing wrong with being a fundamentalist. It simply means you literally interpret the Bible. But what this movement, that these people that latched on to that name fundamentalists, are exceedingly dangerous. They were Protestants in the beginning. Their evangelism was Protestant evangelism. It was deceptive. It was high pressure. It left out true repentance in many cases, tended to, and true faith, and the new birth experience. And I lost my train of thought there. We'll go on with that. I'm getting tired, and I'm sure you are too. But this movement subverted the Southern Baptist Convention in its entirety in a few years. And that's not all. There's hundreds and hundreds of churches that call themselves Fundamental Baptists, Independent Fundamentalists, Bible Baptists, Berean Baptists. That's all part of the fundamentalist Baptist movement, which is not Baptist, but they have pulled out of the convention almost as far back as the Landmarkers did. The ABA and the BMA, and Brother Tim mentioned that, didn't get into it. They are more high pressure and therefore more deceptive than the average Southern Baptist church. Now, the Southern Baptists, with all the mistakes that they made that he was talking about, the biggest one they made is buying into that easy believism, mass evangelism, and using those methods in their churches. By the middle 1900s, by the middle of the 20th century, way more than half, 80-90%, I don't know the makeup because I was only in one spot and don't know how to analyze it, but most Baptists had thrown out their altar prayer and were using the Belly Sunday handshake, most Southern Baptists. That transition took place in a very short time. Well, you say, well, there's no mourners bench demanded in the scriptures. That's right. But they're leaving out the prayer, they're leaving out the brokenhearted conviction, they're leaving out the death to sin, they're leaving out all those things that Brother Binion preaches to you time and time again. Now, I don't know what today, I know in 1950 the Southern Baptist Sunday School Board, maybe one reason I'm so conscious of this, I was in Southwest Missouri and I was just a child. I thank God they had the good sense to do this. The first issue of the Southern Baptist literature that said, I hereby accept Christ as my Savior, sign your name, and bring this to your Sunday school teacher next week, is what caused a great number of churches to say, that's it, and to bail out of the Southern Baptist Convention en masse. Several associations did that. We are not going to have that taught to our children. Well, if the Southern Baptist Sunday School Board printed that in the Sunday School literature for the students to be saved by, then that must be what the Southern Baptist Convention believes. Isn't it? We've got several churches that's been in it a lot longer than that. I mean, stayed in it for recent years. They say, well, we don't believe that. I know that. But why are they in an organization which does? You see, we're all independent. We can do as we please. Mostly because of tradition. In most cases, Mom and Dad were in this. Yes, Mom and Dad were in it, but it was a lot different back then. Well, the fundamentalist movement